On women's reality, and it's the first of five sessions, and it's going to be on what we call the female fear, which is a sense of anxiety, a sense of threat that I hope I'll be able to show you derives from the fear that we have, a kind of inborn fear that's kind of always in the background there, of being raped. And it comes for a whole lot of reasons, but the session today will be on, you know, where it comes from, whether or not it's a realistic kind of fear, what we might want to try to do about it, how we can relate to other people who sense this, who also sense this fear, and so forth. The session tomorrow is going to be on another sad topic, which is battered women. I have a teleplay called "The Price of Daffodils," and it was specifically designed to introduce people to the issues related to battered women, but also to prompt discussion on how people might cope with it, or if you have friends who are in that situation, how they might cope with it. In talking to people here, I've already discovered that there are at least four women here who have been battered wives, and once they knew what the topic was about, they felt comfortable telling me that. So I think it's, even at Holden, we have victims of battering. It's this idyllic setting. You don't expect something like that, at least I didn't, although I've been doing this work long enough that I should know by now that it happens everywhere and anywhere. Later in the week, the topics are a little more cheerful, although there's some negative sides to them. I'm going to do a session on women managing the woman's way, and then the last session will be on something that I call the trivia of everyday life, and just little things that I'm sure that all of you have experienced, and I'm sure that you'll be able to think of ones others other than the ones I bring up. The topic that we're talking about today, women's fear, or the female fear, is a topic of a book that a colleague and I have just finished, and it grew out of the fact that we were working on a big project at Northwestern University on fear of crime. It seemed that fear was a very widespread and pervasive problem in the United States, and some people actually said that the fear of crime was causing more trouble in American communities than crime itself. And the reason for that was because people were restricting their behavior, they weren't going out, they weren't participating in neighborhood organizations and all that kind of thing. And so we started work on this project to see whether or not it really was that pervasive and what was going on. And right away, one of the first things we found was that women were much more fearful than men, despite the fact that women were much less likely to be victims of all kinds of crime except rape. And then it made sense to my colleague and I that women should have more fear because they had an additional crime to fear. And it was one that wasn't taken very seriously by men or by the institutions in our society. And so it seemed to be reasonable to us that that was why women had more fear. And this was across the board we were doing our work in Philadelphia, Chicago, and San Francisco. And it was true of women of all socioeconomic statuses in all neighborhoods. We did 10 different neighborhoods in those three cities. So we decided that we would go ahead and make a separate project that was kind of a co-project along with this other one that was going on at the same time. Our colleagues were upset about it. They didn't want us to do it. They said, if you do this, you're going to ruin our telephone surveys because you start asking questions about rape, people hang up, and you won't be able to get people to talk to you in person, and they just gave us all kinds of grief about it. But we decided to go ahead and do it anyway. And at that time, there happened to be an institute called the National Center for Prevention and Control of Rape had just been started, having been brought into existence by some grassroots women organizers. And it had been located within the National Institutes of Mental Health, and they gave us a grant to do this research, and so we got started on it. I hate to tell you how many years ago, but my son Seth, I was pregnant with my son Seth at the time that we submitted the grant, so you can see, and he's going to be 10 in July, so you can see what how long ago it was. Okay, what is it exactly that I'm talking about? And I'm going to try to read some descriptions and some of the stories of some of the people we interviewed. We talked to, along with the other project, we interviewed 5,000 people on the telephone in Philadelphia, Chicago, and San Francisco, and in 10 different neighborhoods. And in 6 of those 10 neighborhoods, at the end of the telephone interviews, they were all randomly selected, and at the end of the interviews in 6 of the neighborhoods, we asked everybody if they would be willing to be interviewed in person for about an hour or an hour and a half about sexual assault and any precautions that they might take against that crime. And about 45% of the people that we interviewed said yes, they'd like to be interviewed. And we went and interviewed them, and we ended up with about 25% of the people that we had interviewed on the telephone, we in fact interviewed in person. So we had, in those neighborhoods, so we had a total of about 300 women and about 80 men that we interviewed. And that included, or in addition, I should say, we interviewed a few couples, that is, both the husband and wife separately, so they couldn't hear one another's answers. Now, in terms of what it is we're talking about here, I hope that this little something, that the quotation from someone who seemed to understand exactly what we were talking about gets the idea across. I emerged from the warmth and conviviality of a group of friends at a restaurant into the darkness and the emptiness of a city street late at night. My car was just around the corner, but getting to it meant walking under the L track. This is, you can tell instantly, this is from Chicago. The L is the elevated train that goes around the loop main downtown of the city. As I approached the L, I saw a man starting down the street from the other end. I held my breath and began to calculate. Was he bigger than I am? Where could I run if he seemed to going to be attack me? Should I scream? Did he have bad intentions? The bar on the corner was open, but was that a source of safety or of greater danger, as in the New Bedford incident? My anxiety increased as the man approached and the calculations continued. Should I look him directly in the eye, or would that be interpreted as a come on? Should I walk briskly, or did that convey fear as if I were running? The man approached. I held my breath. My heart seemed to stop. He walked past me and continued down the street. And I breathed a sigh of relief. If I had been harmed, would I have been blamed for being in a dangerous place? Would I have blamed myself? I was unharmed, but not untouched by this incident. The fear, the anxiety, the distress, all a part of daily urban life for women. In the interviews that we conducted, we found that not every woman has experienced this kind of fear. But almost every woman said that there were experiences that she had had like that. Not every woman says that she is consumed by this fear in any way or thinks about it all the time. But everyone said that it crossed her mind at least occasionally, and meaning about once a month there will be something that would happen. Almost every woman said that she took precautions and realized that her own behavior was changed as a result of this kind of anxiety. So we really felt that that this was something that we wanted to pursue much further, because for one thing, it's something that each woman experiences privately, and yet it's not something that you go around talking about, and yet when you bring it up, almost every woman knows what you're talking about. I mean, all of you are shaking your head, and not everyone, that doesn't mean that people are sitting around terrified about it. Now, there are some women, those of you, I don't know if you've lived in Silverton, Washington all your life, but women the women who say they don't experience this kind of anxiety or this kind of fear very often are people who've grown up in relatively rural areas and haven't lived in cities and never and didn't have experiences as children where they were frightened by men, by relatives, by a man exposing himself, by being pushed on a date to go farther than you wanted to go, by being forced into, perhaps in marital situations, being forced to, or feel like you're forced to have intercourse when you didn't really feel like it, or having these kinds of experiences. Now, most of the women we interviewed had many of those experiences, if not all of them. And these things that happen in youth end up sort of setting the stage as a precursor for this, for this kind of experience. So it is a private fear, and we think that it should no longer be a private one, that it should be one that women talk about, and because initially, after you talk about it, after you experience it, you begin to have a sort of sense of anger about why should we have to go through this? It just isn't fair that we can't do all kinds of things that we want to do, and especially if you live in cities. Do you all have a general feeling now for what kind of fear it is we're talking about? It's not fear of getting a divorce. It's not fear of losing your job. And both of those have higher priorities. When we ask people what they're afraid of, those two things were the things that they were most afraid of. And yet this, on occasion, this female fear would always come to the forefront and take more precedence over these other fears. There were certain occasions where that would happen. Now, where does this fear come from? Now, it seemed to us that a lot of data backs this up, that what women are taught as children is very very likely to also exacerbate this. I mean, we are all taught as children not to speak to strangers, and particularly if you, boys and girls are told that, but particularly if you're a woman, you somehow get the idea, somehow early on, we haven't been able to quite put our fingers on it, but you get the idea that it's somehow associated with bad touching, or something awful might happen. And you'd be surprised at the number of women who have had some relative that they can recall, an uncle, a brother, sometimes a father, although it tends to be an uncle or a cousin or somebody who touched people touched them as children in the wrong way. We're also taught as young girls, or this is less true now than it used to be in the past, but we're taught that it isn't appropriate to fight back. It isn't appropriate to do all kinds of things that seem to be more appropriate for girls. We are warned in many ways to avoid men and to avoid these problems. Now, we also asked people, we wondered at to what extent it was related to women's feelings of vulnerability, that they felt that they're smaller than men and they can't run as fast as men, and so forth. So we asked those questions too. And the women we interviewed, we expected them to say that they're not as strong as men, and maybe that they couldn't run as fast as men. But by and large, the women, with few exceptions, the women said they were smaller and not as strong and not as fast as other women as well. So they felt very vulnerable. Now, the exceptions to this were the women, the relatively few women in our group who had taken karate or self-defense courses. And those women felt stronger, more powerful, more effective about everything, including their jobs. I mean, it seems to be a very good thing to take self-defense in the sense that they feel more efficacious about just about everything. Now, the next thing that I'd like to bring up is the pervasiveness of this fear. I already talked some about that, but I also wanted to talk about different ways that it gets expressed. A lot of women, when you ask them, "Are you afraid of being raped?" don't really, they haven't conceptualized it that way before, and they don't really think of it in quite that way. But they'll express it in terms of concern about crime, fearfulness for their children or elderly parents living in the house. And men are even more likely to express it in terms of their fear for other people. And in fact, the men in the sample thought the risk of a woman being raped was higher than the women thought it was. I mean, so that they felt even more justified in saying, "Don't go anywhere alone. Go everywhere accompanied by a man who can protect you." And yet, it's the men who are doing this, and very often in dating situations. So there's a lot of different ways that people express their fear, and again, all this is much exacerbated by living in cities. The women in cities have we don't know for sure how much rape there is, but because we just know what women have reported to the police, and last year it was around 90,000 rapes that women reported to the police and that the police counted as a rape. Now, that last phrase, "and the police counted as a rape," cuts out a great many, because the police will, quote, unfound any rape they don't think it should qualify as a rape. In Chicago, that's a very serious problem. There, 2 years ago, there was a woman named Pam Zekman, who is an investigative reporter for one of the local TV channels, and she did an expose in the Chicago police called "Killing Crime, the Cop-Out." And she found that the Chicago police are especially likely to unfound crime, particularly rape. And so the next year, when they began counting the crimes a little more accurately, it turned out that made it look as if there was a 75% increase in rape in Chicago, because they had, in 1 year, because they began to count the crime in a way that they hadn't before. Now, how much rape there is and whether or not it's, quote, realistic to have as much fear as women have, I mean, there's a lot of issues here. There are, as I say, around 90,000 rapes were reported and counted by the police. About twice that many were reported to what we call the victimization surveys. The U.S. Census is done every 10 years, but then every year they have updates where they interview 10,000 people in selected samples and so forth. And when they do that, yearly ones, they ask questions about whether or not anyone in the household has been victimized. Now, you have to have said yes to a lot of these questions before the question ever comes up, was anyone in your household sexually assaulted? So there's a lot of opportunity for people to say no, and that's only about the preceding 12 months. So, and sometimes people can't remember whether it was 13 months ago or 12 months ago or 11 months ago or whatever. And besides, they may not want to talk about it to the stranger that's come in the house. So they may just say no and avoid the whole question. But in any case, to the victimization surveyors, there's at least twice as many rapes are reported to them as to the police. Now, in addition, we know that there are lots and lots of women who've been assaulted who don't tell anyone, or certainly they don't tell anyone in any kind of official position. So even though all these statistics and computers and so forth make it very possible for the lots of record keeping to be being done, we still don't really know how much there is, because we don't know how much goes unreported. Our best guess is that it's probably about four times, between four and five times the amount that's reported to the police, which means that when you calculate it all out, it means that in any given year in a large city, there's something like 10 women out of every 1,000, 10 to 20 women out of every 1,000 who are actually raped. Now, there's even more who have attempts made, and very few attempts are reported to the police, because women just figure that they're lucky to get out of it, and many women don't know that attempted rape is a crime. Nearly everybody knows that rape is a crime, but most women don't know that attempted rape is also a crime. So very often this is related to fear in another way, because and one of the ways that's been most important to my colleague and I is that whether or not, or I should start over again, even though relatively few women have been raped. Now, I just told you that lots of women have been raped. And so, but yet, I mean, when you think about it, even though those rates are very high, they're the highest in the world for any countries that are keeping records, any industrialized countries. I mean, they're much higher than European, much higher than the Far Eastern. We may want to raise questions about why our country is so violent. Even though huge numbers of women have been attacked, there's still an even larger number who haven't been assaulted. And yet, to know about the consequences of these assaults, to know how the institutions in our country deal with it, how the police deal with it, how the media deal with it, means that we have lots of good reason to be afraid. When you see the consequences of rape, what it does to women's lives, it makes other people, even those who haven't been raped, fearful. And it makes their families fearful. And it affects our day-to-day lives very, very much. Now, I'd like to read a story of actually a friend of mine, and it seems to me particularly pertinent here, because she, at the time of her attack, was in the training for the ministry. Susan is now 29, white, and a minister. Late in 1983, she and five friends, two other white women and three men, one black, one white, and one American Indian, had gathered in her apartment for a simple Friday evening meal before a religious meeting. One of the men unlocked and opened the apartment door on his way to get something he'd left in his car. He was stopped in the hallway by a black man with a gun. The man with a gun was angry when the group of six could only come up with $40 from their wallets. He waved the gun and cocked the hammer. Fearful, Susan spoke up and said she had some more money hidden in the other room. The man made her tie up her friends with dish towels, electric cords, or anything else she could find. He also made her remove their watches and give them to him. After Susan gave the man the $140 she had hidden in her dresser, he pulled her to him and whispered, "Now you're going to make love to me." "No, no," was all she could say before he cocked the hammer of the gun again and said, "Don't fight me." Then she said, "Okay, if I go through with this, will you just leave and not hurt any of us?" "Yeah," he said. He forced her onto her own bed and attempted to rape her from the back. Then he told her to turn over and close her eyes. Then he raped her from the front. When he was through, he wiped her off with her own bathrobe and told her to get dressed. After she dressed, he forced her to go through the apartment searching for more money. When no more was to be found, he had her lie down on the bathroom floor and count to 100. She did, and when she opened her eyes, he was still there staring down at her. He told her to count to 100 again. This time, when she opened her eyes, he was gone. By the time she got up, got dressed, and went back, shaking, into the living room, most of her friends had freed themselves, and one was calling the police. Only her roommate guessed what had happened to Susan. After the police had been there a few minutes, Susan's roommate told them there had also been a rape. They said, "Well, why didn't you tell us in the first place?" and called a victim advocate to meet them at the hospital. There, the advocate told Susan she didn't have to answer a prying nurse's question. The nurse then quietly examined her and gave her massive doses of penicillin to prevent infection and other pills to prevent pregnancy by inducing menstruation. Susan spent that night and many more at another friend's, a 50-year-old woman whose own daughter had been raped at gunpoint in a suburban restaurant during a robbery about a year earlier. After a sleepless night of nearly constant crying, Susan and her friend called us, thinking our research on rape might help enable us to help Susan understand what she was feeling. She wanted to know more about what happens to women who are raped and when the terrible emotional pain and fear might be over. That same morning, There were stories in the major newspapers headlined, "Rapist Invades Bible Study Group." Many of the facts in the stories were incorrect. Two nights later, someone re-entered Susan's apartment and took everything but her clothes and large pieces of furniture. The next day, the Tylenol case broke in Chicago, you know, when the cyanide-laced Tylenol pills, and Susan and the police shifted their attention to that. Weeks later, Susan still couldn't bring herself to sleep on any bed. She had nightmares. Far from rich to begin with, she was without money and many of her belongings. Friends and her minister contributed a small fund to help her replace some of what was gone, but there was no way to recover personal mementos and belongings with sentimental value. Susan couldn't concentrate on her work. She felt angry and then depressed. She saw a therapist and talked to friends and said tearfully, "I don't like the person I've become. I'm afraid, depressed, out of energy. I get angry and it sometimes comes out on people who don't deserve it. I don't know what to do, where to turn, where to live or work. I want to believe so much that people can live in the city." Susan's a sensible woman who took a lot of precautions women are advised to take. She wasn't raped on the street or in a dark alley after getting off the subway alone at night. She wasn't wearing provocative clothes. She says, "If I'm not safe, locked inside my own apartment, surrounded by five other people, where can I be safe?" Susan didn't tell her family about the rape, though she did tell them about the robbery in order to explain why she moved to a new apartment. She's afraid of their reactions if she were to say more. The woman she moved in with temporarily was saddened and depressed by what had happened to Susan. And when she left for a week-long conference, Susan moved out, still afraid to be alone, in with another 50-year-old woman and her son from church. That woman, too, had been raped 2 years earlier by a young black teenager who also robbed her. Susan's friends and students, part of a group wanting to commit themselves to urban ministry, grew more afraid than they had been, taking more precautions, avoiding evening meetings and leisure activities outside of their home, avoiding travel alone on public transportation, thinking out their options rather than taking them for granted. They too experienced fear, anger, and a sense of helpless dismay. Susan moved several times during the year, looking for a place and roommates with whom she could feel comfortable. About 10 months after the rape, she and two young women, an artist and a teacher, moved into a 3-bedroom flat several miles from her old neighborhood, but still in the city. The police never contacted her again, so she assumed the robber rapist is at large, maybe not too far away. About a year after the rape, Susan gathered her friends for a rite of passage, a ritual marking an end to her year of anger, anxiety, mourning, and grieving. She began the ceremony by playing music which portrayed the revival of the human spirit after tragedy and pain. After the music stopped, Susan explained to the 10 women and 2 men gathered there that each had been for her as the water in the song, rushing again, persistent, comforting, and faithful. She said it had been a difficult year, but she felt at the end of it as if she were a survivor, not a victim. Then she told how she remembered each with respect to her rape and its consequences during the year. Then Susan invited the participants to share their own thoughts about her experience or about sexual assaults and violence more generally. One friend spoke of her sense of anger and injustice upon hearing of Susan's rape and of wishing only evil for the rapist. Another said she believed that Susan had suffered for her and that if she were now to be raped herself, that she knew she too would be able to survive since Susan had taught her how and had led her through the suffering. Another, a black man, told how he had prayed on hearing of the rape, "Oh God, don't let him be black." Another said Susan's experience had caused her to further question the existence of God. At the very least, God must have been on a vacation, she said. Another said that the irrationality and clearly unprovoked nature of Susan's rape caused her to feel even more determined to attack the causes, which she believes are the generally high tolerance of violence in the U.S., the inequitable distribution of wealth in our society, and sexual child abuse. After a few moments of silence, waiting to see if anyone else wanted to speak, a woman who had until then remained silent, read a poem from a book called Women in Transition. Then she noted that each guest had been asked to bring to the gathering symbols of hope and healing, and that now was the appropriate time to discuss them. She then presented Susan with a small glass container filled with apricot tea and said that it symbolized the times that she and Susan had shared a warm, a cup of warm and comforting tea and the similar healing time she had shared with other women. Another woman gave Susan a plate of brownies she'd made that afternoon and said she just wanted to give Susan something, and that was all she could think of at the time. One of Susan's new roommates said it was a sign of hope and healing that the three of them could laugh and enjoy their encounters with men they were dating, and especially about Susan's newly re-emerging sexuality. Another brought three symbols, a note of love and healing that Susan had written to her, a daisy to accompany the E.E. Cummings poem that concludes, "I thank heaven someone's crazy enough to give me a daisy," and a brass bracelet she'd been wearing for about a year and wanted Susan to have. Still another read a passage from Color Me Purple that was especially meaningful to her, and then gave Susan her well-worn and marked-up copy of the book. The other new roommate told a story about what she had regarded as a rather ugly piece of pottery given to her by a student, and how, as her relationship to the student blossomed, her view of the pottery changed so that she began to see it as attractive. Another woman, also a minister, read a message of hope from a collection of religious messages and then gave her the booklet. At about this time, one of the two men present, also a minister, brought bread and wine to the center of the room and consecrated them for communion. When he'd finished, he passed the bread and asked Susan to offer the wine to each. As she did so, she said softly, "The cup of healing." When each person had been served, the group stood with arms encircled and sang "Amazing Grace." At the conclusion of the hymn, those who wished offered prayers for the future, and the ritual was concluded by those present sharing sherbet and brownies. We felt that 10 lives had been permanently changed by Susan's rape. Just short, at least 10 lives, I mean, certainly those in the room, but many others as well. Just 2 short years after her rape, Susan took a position as a pastor of 2 small rural churches about 80 miles from Chicago. She had to live alone in a relatively isolated area and often felt very uncomfortable and sometimes afraid. She dreaded the second anniversary of the rape and made sure she spent it with some of her new and unknowing acquaintances. She survived it, but realized her life would never be the same. Susan is probably not a typical rape victim. Our work has led us to the conviction that no one is. Yet the aftermath of Susan's rape for her and for her friends and colleagues mirrors the experiences of many affected by this crime. We're concerned in our work, we're concerned about the effects on Susan, but we're also concerned about all the friends and acquaintances and family members of Susan. Now, we learned a lot from Susan, as you can probably tell, and there are many other things that we went on to learn about in our work. The main thing, I see what time it is now, the main other thing I want to share with you now is how these kinds of experiences end up affecting non-victims. And that is that the women we interviewed all told us that for them, the major consequences are what they do in their day-to-day lives to protect themselves from these kinds of experiences. And that there are 2 general forms that people take. One we call avoidance, and that is women do all kinds of things to avoid danger. And the other main thing they do is to isolate themselves from other people, most often by staying home. Now, home is not a safe place to be, necessarily, since 33% of the reported rapes take place in women's homes, just as this one did. And yet, most people feel safe in their home and should. I mean, we want women to feel safe in their homes. Now, there's the combination of these things, isolating behaviors and avoidance behaviors, how different people, what proportion of which kind of behaviors people engage in seems to depend on how educated they are, whether or not they work, how much money they have. People who can afford to live in buildings where they have security guards or whatever feel safer than people who don't. But in general, there's a lot of this kind of thing where in the sense that they were willing to share with us the kinds of things that they do every day to protect themselves, and we see almost all of them as behaviors which restrict. In a way, it's a self they do it willingly to protect themselves, and yet it's very, very restrictive on their day-to-day lives. Now, I could also go on about what kinds of things people can do to protect themselves that aren't so self-restricting, but I really do think that it's time to try to get some reactions from you and maybe some experiences that you've had or know in reactions to other people's rapes or things that you've thought of or participated in your communities. The Take Back the Night marches that were relatively frequent 3 or 4 years ago seem to have been very effective in many communities in raising the consciousness of men in the communities as well. Anything that's been done about this issue has been done by women today it's not really surprising, but there are no men here. Jody came in and left. I don't know. And I think that it is a women, something that women have to worry about, and yet it is a men's issue. Can y'all look very serious? It is a serious topic. It's one that's very hard to work on because you can't. There's no humor, and it's hard to have a job and work on things where it's inappropriate to tell jokes.
Well, I was born and raised in the city of Detroit, and I don't know, as I was growing up there, I was there for 17 years of my life, whether I actually was consciously thinking of rape or not, but we definitely, as women, did not go out alone. And even as a group of girls, I know we always carried hat pins in right here in our coats. And if we would see men on one side of the street, we would cross to the other side. And the only victims I ever knew of were not rape victims, but they were purse snatching type things. Mm-hmm. So whether I was thinking beyond that, I can't tell you at this point in my life, but there was a fear of men. And one was a neighborhood girl who was a few years older than I, who was actually jumped on her own front porch. A man jumped out from behind a bush, and he evidently knew that she came home from work at a certain time. She was like 20 or something. And then my own mother came home one night, pounding on the door to be let in because she had been attacked by two young men who had just grabbed her purse. But it was a very frightening thing, and I think that stuck with me. So I avoided being by myself, and even avoided being out at night, you know. And we were just real, real aware, and we did the avoidance thing, you know, I should say. So that was part of my growing up, was to be careful about being alone or being out after dark.
But a couple of years ago, I was at a convention at the Renaissance Center in Detroit. And the second day of it was a 4 or 5 day convention, and the second day of the convention, all of a sudden there appeared notices everywhere, do not use the hotel bathrooms.
Oh yeah.
And to go into, if you needed to go to the bathroom, either go back to your hotel room or go into the bathrooms in the that were inside the restaurants that were inside the hotel.
Well, since
and it turned out there had been two rapes the first day.
Well, since I have moved from Detroit, I know the neighborhood high school I went to, I know that my mother and dad stayed in that neighborhood, that they knew young women who did not go to the bathroom all day long in high school because they were afraid to go into the bathrooms even. And that was attacks by other women. And and that was a neighborhood that was changing from white to black, and it was
never
more of a racial thing. But they also had policemen walking the halls of the schools. So that was just an ordinary thing.
When I've listened to John and Carol Avery during this week talk about Saudi Arabia and the rules on women, you know, they have their face covered and all this stuff, it struck me that in Chicago we have rules on women too, and it's like we have a written law that says you can't ride the L after dark, you can't go to movies alone, you can't go to restaurants alone, you can't walk the street alone after dark. You know, it's like it's all written down in laws. It might just well be.
And if something happens, it's your own fault.
Sure.
If you do those things.
Yeah, because you shouldn't be out. You know you shouldn't be out.
Women can't leave the house and go for a walk at night. You know, that's crazy. Even if it's a warm spring night, you're asking for trouble. So if you break those laws, then you pay the consequences and they act like you're guilty.
What sort of ethnic sampling did you have among the women, and did you find any kind of proportion differences between ethnic groups as to the amount of fear or the number of experiences that fear is related to?
Yeah, we did. And in general, of course, there's exceptions to every single thing. I mean, we had blacks, for minority groups. We had blacks, we had Asians, and we had Hispanics. And the and we conducted the interviews in those languages with those, with Hispanics and Asians, if they, you know, they weren't very conversant in English. The general rule is that the fewer resources people had in terms of either money or education, the more fearful they were and the more precautions they took. We did find that black women were much more likely to have been attacked than whites, and Hispanics were less likely to have been attacked than whites, but it was close, and Asians were the least likely of all to have been attacked. Now, it's also possible that they were the least likely to have been willing to tell us. Now, we did find that when we asked our question, unlike the all the police data and the victimization survey data, when we asked our question, we didn't say, have you been attacked in the last 12 months? I mean, first we asked, do you personally know anyone who has been attacked? And it turned out that very often the person they knew was themselves. But we asked the question, because we were interested in fear, we asked the question, have you ever been attacked? And we got in this sort of self-selected sample from a random sample, we had 6% of the people who told us on the phone, 6% of the women who told us on the phone that they had been sexually assaulted. And then when we interviewed the same 300 group of women in person, about twice as many said that they had been assaulted themselves. And it was, I mean, it about doubled. I mean, well, I told you no on the phone, but, you know, it really happened to me.
Personal contact enabled that kind of...
And our interviewers, we had very skilled interviewers who were very sensitive to all these issues, and if they showed any kind of upset or any kind of concern, and they indicated that they had experiences like this in the past, we got money enough in our grant to pay for them to see a therapist if they wanted to, and we also provided a list of places they could get help in their communities. And many of them didn't know, you know, they didn't know about places where they could get help in their communities, and were very glad to have the list. I mean, almost everyone wanted the list, even if there hadn't been anything happen in their families. Anybody?
Sometimes I have a scary thought. Every rapist has a mother.
Mm-hmm.
What can we as women do to change this? I mean, I'm raising a son. And I can't see him as being a rapist, but I don't think any mother could think of their son as being a rapist.
Well, my colleague and I both had young sons during the time we were doing this project, and we had the same conversation. You know, we think we're doing the right things, but, you know, what if we're not? Well, the best way I can answer that question is to tell you about some work of a friend named Nicholas Groth, who works in a prison in Summer, Connecticut with convicted rapists. And he found that an absolute staggering percentage, of something like 80% of the convicted rapists, who may be different from those who are never caught, and very few are caught and convicted. So these ones that are caught and convicted, you know, may be a wholly different group, but of those that he worked with, about 80% had themselves been sexually assaulted as children. And what happened was that, and very often not by the mother, sometimes by the mother, but very often by a babysitter or some man. Many of them had lived in foster homes or in children's homes or reform schools or whatever where they were attacked. And the way Nick explained it was that these young boys would have been aggressed against, and that it's such a traumatic experience for people to be sexually assaulted, young children, that their emotional growth stops at the age that they were assaulted. So if it's 4 years old, they remain emotionally 4 years old, or if 10 years old, they remain emotionally 10 years old, even though they may get chronologically older. And then at some point later, they become the aggressors themselves, and that the only way he can deal with them therapeutically is to get them back to that emotional age when they were attacked, and then try to work with them beyond that. Now, the other thing that he and others have said is that it's very, very important to teach young boys and women too that it's not acceptable to deal with conflict, to deal with your emotions in a violent way. That you have to learn to identify your emotions and express them verbally. And many, many, many convicted felons, and especially convicted rapists and child molesters, don't know how to express themselves verbally. They've never been taught. They grew up in situations where if you were upset, you smacked someone. Or if you felt your manhood was assaulted in any way, you had a fight with someone. You didn't talk and discuss it and stop and discuss it. And they just so another thing that he and others do is they have all these sessions with people where the only programs where they've had any success in terms of recidivism, when these men get out of prison and don't instantly go commit the same kind of crime again, is in these programs where they have taught people to figure out what they're feeling and to talk about it. And so verbal expression, teaching people to express themselves verbally, seems to be very, very important. I'm trying to think what else. Most of the rapists in his studies are married at the time and having a sexual relationship. They tend to be mostly what he calls power rapes. About 40% of the rapes are power rapes, and another 30 or 40% are anger rapes. And there's only about 5% that are these fluky, crazy things where they're, they're very, in addition, very sick mentally and trying to get back at their mothers and actually think they're raping their mothers and this kind of thing. And most, 80 to 90% of them have profiles very similar to any other convicted felon, except that this very large percentage of them has been sexually assaulted as children. Now, many convicted felons, even if they haven't committed rapes, many convicted felons have also been attacked or abused as children. 20 or 30% have, in the studies that he did, had been abused or sexually abused. But of those that were convicted for rape, of this very high percentage were sexually assaulted.
I think the prison population too, there's a high correlation with men who had very few positive models, mm-hmm. but male figures, or absolutely no male figures in the home or in their immediate life, sort of
to
living.
To answer her question on how to raise your child, you don't have to be worried about him. Just make sure you tell your child you love him. Make sure he learns to say that back to you, and give him an opportunity each day to tell him about what he's telling you about what he's been doing, and encourage him to just be open, that you're open and willing to listen to him. And that's all you can do. Pray a lot.
Sounds like what you'd be indicating would be that that men and women respond differently to being raped.
Mm-hmm.
If there's such a high correlation between men being assaulted sexually and then later acting out in criminal behavior, and women get assaulted sexually and they act it out with the tortoise behavior. I mean, they hide to protect themselves,
yeah.
or withdraw that. It seems like it's not just the sexual assault that determines behavior. There's something else going on,
yeah.
that is some other major factor that is pushing those behaviors in the direction.
Yeah, a lot depends, of course, on what was going on with a woman before the rape. Now, a huge percentage of married women who get raped end up within 2 years of getting divorced, because the sexual relationship, any ongoing sexual relationship, is always, I mean, this is 100%, it's always disturbed. I mean, nobody can just resume sexual relations after this kind of experience. And the way the, quote, significant others in her life respond, her husband, a boyfriend, children, daughters, whatever, the way they respond in the situation has an awful lot to do with how well and how quickly she recovers from the experience. I mean, there is something called the rape trauma syndrome that was identified by two researchers who did a lot of work with rape victims in Boston. And there's a sort of sequence of steps that most rape victims appear to go through. And the first one is this tremendous fear that, I mean, they're just absolutely terrified of anything that moves. And then that may subside after an hour or two, or it may be several weeks. And then there's the second sort of stage of blaming themselves. What could I have done to prevent this? Should I have, you know, should I have been somewhere else? Could I have worn different clothes? Could I have, you know, should I have fought? Should I have not fought? Should I, you know, whatever they do, it's wrong. And then the... Then after that stage, then there's this very often a feeling of anger, and you know I'm going to get that person or whatever. And then finally, there's a sort of resumption of semi-normal behavior. But everyone reports, and then that may take as long as 4 or 5 years, and may be delayed if the person is going through some kind of terrible court situation, or if they've been badly treated by police or badly treated by doctors in the hospital. And the whole thing of how you gather evidence, of how they gather the evidence, and how they, I mean, if you can believe it, I mean, lots and lots of women until the last year or so, victims, were expected to keep the hospital evidence in their own refrigerators and then bring it to court at the appropriate times and everything. I mean, it's just, now that all that kind of thing has changed in the past 2 or 3 years, and there are now much more systematic ways of gathering evidence, and most of the laws have been reformed in almost every state. There's been a lot of legal reform. So things, again, particularly in large cities, the things that actually are better in terms of police and courts than they used to be. It used to be that women had to take lie detector tests when they reported a rape.
It seems to me all this sounds like the actual physical rape is the least of your worries. It's the aftermath and the
That's
way
right.
the friends and family deal with it. Is there a way that we should learn about how to cope with someone? You know, hoping it's not us. You know, that's the next step, is it's your friend instead of you.
Yeah.
Should we learn about it ahead of time, or does that sort of learning really not help the person until they're actually there talking to you? And then, you know, study up about it or something.
Well, I think it helps a lot to learn what happens to victims, to learn and to think through what you yourself might do in the situation. Now, thinking it through and assessing your own capabilities and so forth doesn't mean that that's the way you would act in that kind of a situation.
Yeah.
And yet, if you have thought it through, you at least might know what some of the options are. I mean, a lot of research now shows that women very often are better off if they do fight. Now, you used to hear there's some man whose name I keep.
You were
not survival,
the victim because
right,
you survived. Yeah.
Well, and that even if you don't, even if you end up getting raped, you know you tried, because a lot of women end up feeling guilty that they didn't fight. And showing, see, in all court situations before these reforms, one of the major things women had to show in court was that it was against their will. Well, how do you prove that after the fact when somebody else says, well, she really wanted it, you know?
Especially if they don't have a weapon or something.
Right.
Right. And so one way you could show that it was against your will was if you were all black and blue.
Mm.
You know, if you fought.
Skin under your fingernails.
Yeah. If you fought, that was a sign that it was against your will, but it still wasn't proof. You know, there's all these laws were written for men, you know, by men.
To protect men. From some kind of mistaken, irate woman would want to get even with a man, therefore she would figure out this.
Yeah, or a woman who had sex and then thought better of it afterwards, and so she claimed she was raped. And yet, I mean, even the police, who seem to be the most hard-boiled about these things, don't think that happens very often. That there are very, very few women who go to the police and report a rape who don't, you know. Now this Kathleen Crowell Rebb, Webb and this Gary Dotson case that was all over, that did not help the women's issues.
No.
At all.
I can't want to put it back a few pages in the paper.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, it is, there are lots of things that can be done now. There are films on date rape, because a lot of rapes happen on dates. And then especially women are afraid to report. Because they think it won't do any good. Or that it was their own fault, because they went out, after all, they went out with this person. Then there are films that people can see. There's this National Center for Prevention and Control of Rape, which has prepared lots of materials and funded lots of research now that people can use. There are, in many, many towns, there are self-defense classes, which, as I say, it said earlier, seem to have a wonderful effect on women in terms of making them feel better and stronger and more efficacious about absolutely everything. I mean, and they can, again, you don't know for sure what you're going to do in a specific situation, but it can help a lot to at least give you some idea of what your options are. The main thing in terms of self-blame that is important to understand is that how it ends up affecting a woman depends a lot on whether she thinks that it happened to her because she's an unlucky person, a bad person, what one psychologist calls characterological self-blame, as opposed to situational. I was in the wrong place, I shouldn't have. And to some extent, it helps women to cope with it if they think that it was a situational thing that they could have done something about. And yet so many, on the one hand, we want women to understand that it is a crime that happens anywhere, anytime, and they can't blame themselves for it happening, and that they shouldn't blame themselves. And yet, on the other hand, if that's the message you get across, then people think they can't do anything about it to prevent it.